This nation was founded on the principle that all men are created equal.
We hold these truths to be self-evident.
That all men are created equal.
I'll tell you what freedom is to me. No fear. I mean, really, no fear.
Created equal.
From WDET in Detroit, this is Created Equal. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I'm here in the studio with the show's producer, Carrie Jr. the second.
Happy Juneteenth, Stephen.
Happy Juneteenth to you, mm-hmm. Carrie. And that's a great place to start our conversation because we are talking about the fact that it's Juneteenth, now a national holiday, which means just about everybody seems to get it off. You know, I think there are some real questions, though, about why we celebrate this holiday in this way and what we're supposed to do on Juneteenth. Like, how do we observe Juneteenth?
Well, yeah, the holiday has been recognized in the South, and particularly in Texas, where Juneteenth occurred originally. For me, so far, it's just been almost like another holiday, a day off, you know, barbecue. But for me, it's just been a newer experience. I'm trying to still figure out how to get my feet wet. Anything specific for you?
So, I mean, I don't have a way to mark the holiday or a celebration that I have in mind. I think for me, it's about how you try to make sense of this holiday now, right? It's commemorating something that happened in 1865. Why in 2024 do we still recognize it? And I think an easy way to think about that is that, you know, the end of the war is this kind of chaotic time when you're trying to restore the Union. You are trying to figure out what to do with 600,000 deaths, and you're trying to make African Americans, 4 million African Americans, full citizens. And it produces a lot of, you know, crazy outcomes, things that fall way short of the ideal. And Juneteenth, I think, is a really good beginning for that understanding that these people were supposed to be freed 2 years before it happened, and certainly 2 months before when the war ended, and they weren't. And that kind of injustice frames the things that we'll deal with for, you know, for the future here in America.
Yeah. A lot of the show, I think we're doing that on this episode, but like this show in general really highlights those points in history. We identify structures that make addressing our racial history more difficult. Right. And it's in that spirit that we've kind of selected a few conversations from when we started in February that analyzed like what attempts have been made and are still being made to reckon with that history.
So the first thing we're going to do is listen back to a conversation I had with Gary Orfield, who is one of the nation's premier researchers on the concepts around and the execution of school desegregation. And he had some new data that show that we're not much better off in terms of desegregating schools now than we were when Brown v. Board of Education was decided back in 1954, 70 years ago.
Literally 70 years ago, yeah. Gary Orfield, he's a research professor of education law and political science at the University of California, Los Angeles, and he co-authored this report, and it's titled The Unfinished Battle for Integration in a Multiracial America from Brown Till Now. And you and Orfield are really talking about, specifically in Detroit, what integration might look like, because it seems like we were trying to, at a point, achieve that through schools, and it might be better done elsewhere.
Yeah. There's a proxy that's been assigned to schools to deal with segregation that really finds its roots in other places, especially in housing. Talking about school segregation, how much of it is still with us, and what outcomes that is producing. Dr. Orfield, I'm going to start this part of the conversation talking more about Detroit, Metro Detroit. So if you were looking at a map of Detroit and its suburbs and thinking about how to achieve the kind of integration that we might have dreamed of when Brown v. Board of Education was decided, where would you start? What would you do? Would you go back to busing, which was the tool of the 70s? Or are there other things that you would imagine would get us there quicker or more effectively?
Well, I think there's a number of things you can do. The first important thing to do is to say we want to have an integrated society where communities are integrated and the integration lasts and that we can live together and understand each other better. If that becomes a goal, then there's a lot of tools that could be used.
Okay.
And if we're thinking about the suburbs, we need to think about where racial change is going on, where resegregation seems to be threatened, how we can think about regional cooperation, and how we what new opportunities we can create. Where we have two or three little suburban areas near each other, can we combine them and support some magnet schools that would offer opportunities that don't exist in any of those individual school districts?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And can we work on race relations in our schools? You know, one of the reasons that neighborhoods change is that conditions aren't good in the schools. The kids are fighting. They're not getting along well. They don't understand each other. People don't feel welcome in the school, one group or another. We know how to make that work better. We know how to train staffs. We know how to create better race relations, make sure that things are done equitably inside of schools. We don't really work on that. All of that's really important. In terms of real estate, I would say, look at what's happening to your housing market. If only Black people or only Latinos are being shown housing in your area, something is wrong and it's a violation of civil rights and it's got to be stopped. And it won't be stopped unless serious energy is put on it, monitoring and prosecuting of racial steering, for example. We need to think about where we want to come out, and there really isn't a viable future except lasting integration, unless we want to go through endless rounds of resegregation. And we need to think about how we can take the problem and make it into opportunities by creating broader and more interesting options for students and supporting them in a way that conflicts are eliminated and understanding grows. It won't happen unless we decide we want it to happen. But if we don't decide it, well, it'll be huge cost because none of the families will get what they wanted. The Black families that left Detroit want to have a stable middle class neighborhood. They don't want to be in a resegregated neighborhood with a lot where most of the kids are poor. The white families that live there want the same kind of thing. They won't get it unless there's a plan, some serious effort to make that happen.
I want to note that one thing you did not mention is forced deseg, forced integration, and I wonder.
I was in favor of it. We can't get it now. There's no way we can get it because the Supreme Court has made it impossible with its decisions. But there's a lot we can do with other tools that we need to do.
Would forced integration work? Let's say you could change the Supreme Court's mind, probably not this particular Supreme Court.
It depends on how you do it.
Yeah.
If you send all the kids to majority middle-class schools and support them well, it certainly can work. I was involved in Louisville where it worked for more than 50 years without a court order because it was actually successful and the students and the parents liked the results. And so did the community leaders. The business leaders said you could hire people from any school. They knew how to work together. Where it works, you know, I did a study of a suburb outside of Chicago, Oak Park. It's been integrated now for 60 years. Everybody wants to live there. The housing market draws people from every racial background. It has a very good schools. You know, they made it work. They decided how they wanted to come out, and they took after every element that produced resegregation, like the way sleazy businesses move into areas that are beginning to go through racial change. They stopped it. They worked with their realtors, and they said, you know, if people want to move into our community, if they're white, show them some houses in black areas. If they're black, show them some houses in white areas. You know, expand their possibilities rather than constrict them.
Yeah. I guess one of the things I'm trying to get at here, though, is whether you think the country is willing to indulge integration and the idea of kind of multiracial communities and institutions, or whether it still needs to be pushed, kind of shoved toward that in order to kind of break through these barriers that, as you point out, are about not knowing, are about not understanding the value of these things. Or is there a balance that you got to strike between those two things?
Well, I think there's a balance. And in the best of worlds, we would have our courts pushing us to think about a way to do this and communities working on positive ways, turning lemons into lemonade. Right now, we have courts that are destroying civil rights. You know, the Supreme Court has eliminated affirmative action last year. It's really radically reduced the Voting Rights Act. Mm-hmm. It's hostile to civil mm-hmm. rights. It's the most conservative Supreme Court we've had in at least 80 years. The Supreme Court isn't going to do it. That's why in Minnesota and New Jersey right now, they're trying to get state courts to do it. I think that is a possibility in states that have good state Supreme Courts. But for the moment, most of it, this is on us. It's on us to try to make our school and housing policies and our urban planning work differently.
Mm-hmm.
And there isn't much leadership about it. But if you, one of the reasons we do these reports is to show that what happens if you don't do anything. If you don't do anything, we're going to have a very polarized society, and a lot of the talent in our society isn't going to be developed, and the race relations are going to be bad. And we know what bad race relations look like because we have politics that are just stirring up bad race relations in our country, and it's incredibly destructive to the future of communities.
Yeah.
So if you look at where we're going, it's not a viable future. Understanding that is part of the process we need to go through. The next part is saying where we want to go, what kind of society we'd like to have. Do we have workable examples of that? Yes, we do. Are we going to have any leadership about it? That's where the people who run our school systems need to think about this in a creative way. We also need to think about how this could play a role in revitalization of our central cities. Every big city in California is now having a lot of gentrification.
Mm-hmm.
People are moving back to the city, and I know there's small areas of Detroit where that's happening. It won't happen on scale where you get middle-class families of all races moving back from the suburbs to the central city unless you can offer viable integrated schools. They won't come.
Yeah.
But if you want them to come and stay and to support your central city, you need to figure out how to offer them schools where their kids will not be isolated and they will be prepared for college. That's a challenge that most of our central city school systems haven't met yet, but it's also a big opportunity for them if they meet it successfully.
So last question, if you had to hold up a community that you think is kind of a beacon of kind of hope around this idea, this ideal of integrated schools and what they produce for not only black and brown students, but also for white students, what community would that be?
Well, one of the communities I look at is Berkeley, California, which is a university town, but it has a very poor black community.
Mm-hmm.
They've been integrated voluntarily now since 1965. They don't produce complete equality, but those students of color that go to those schools tend to do much better in lives than students who go to segregated schools in Oakland or someplace else. I think about Connecticut, where you have regional magnet schools in all of the metros, where kids of all races want to go and where there's waiting lists. Why don't we do that? That's an improving opportunity rather than constricting it and producing opportunities for kids who will not get ready for college if they're in a segregated, high-poverty inner-city school, to get ready to go to any college in the country. We can figure out, that's not rocket science to do, and it doesn't constrict anybody's opportunity. It just takes leadership, and it takes willingness to invest some resources, but it can produce much better outcomes.
Yeah.
We don't have a lot of big examples of this because the politics and the developments have been negative, but they do exist, and we did learn a lot in the desegregation era, and we could do much better. And if we don't do it, it's on us, because we're going in a path that doesn't work. We know it won't work. So let's think about having some leadership to expand the opportunities for a much more constructive relationship between kids of different racial and ethnic groups. We're not giving these kids a fair chance. We're not doing some things that would make our communities work better in the future. We're not developing a lot of our talent. We can do a lot better.
Yeah. That was Gary Orfield. He's a research professor at the University of California, Los Angeles, and his research suggests that our schools are about as segregated today as they were 70 years ago. Coming up, there are plans by the state of Michigan to remove a freeway that was built through black neighborhoods in Detroit. We're going to revisit a conversation with a coalition that is raising real concerns about the plans and how they might remediate the things we got wrong in the past. We'll be right back with more Created Equal.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.
We're back with more of Created Equal on Juneteenth, 2024. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I'm here with Carrie Jr. II, who is the show's producer. In this next segment, we're going to hear a bit of a conversation we had pretty recently about the I-375 remake that is underway here in the city of Detroit. The idea, supposedly, is to try to correct some of the wrongs that were done when the freeway and some other things were built. They destroyed some black neighborhoods. There's a coalition of people who live in the area now, though, who are really concerned about what's happening and don't feel like it's about to fulfill the promise of, again, equality that's been put out there.
Yeah, the Michigan Department of Transportation, they created this multi-year plan called I-375 Reconnecting Communities Project, which is essentially the project you're talking about, Stephen, to reimagine what this freeway would be. They're going to tear it up. And this coalition of community members called Rethink I-375, they're trying to gather at least 100 signatures for a letter addressed to the mayor and the governor, city council, and other officials throughout the area to say, this isn't exactly what we want this area to look like for our neighborhood, for our community. And we don't know or feel as if the initial proposal that MDOT has released addresses the historical wrongs that were done to these communities there before.
We had Malachi Barrett, who is a reporter at Bridge Detroit, who's been following this issue really closely and has been writing about it, wrote about this coalition. We also have Olga Stella and Carl Bentley, who are two members of the coalition. Both of them live in the area that would be affected by all of this change around I-375. so we're going to pick up in the conversation mm-hmm. at a point where we're talking about how the state of Michigan might think about this, given some other communities around the country that are rethinking similar projects, taking highways and remaking the area around them to repair communities that were destroyed. I want to start this segment talking about something that I learned about not too long ago when I visited Minneapolis, Minnesota. The city of St. Paul is also thinking about reparations and how to fix the damage that was done by the construction of a highway. And that's been a pretty controversial project in that city. But they also have come up with some really interesting ideas that, I don't know, seem like they might apply here in Detroit. There is a program called the Inheritance Fund in St. Paul. This is a fund that is available to people whose families lived in the neighborhood that was destroyed by the highway. They can get down payment assistance. They can have access to a homeowner rehab program. They're handing out as much as $100,000 per family to buy homes, either in this area or in other areas. In other words, they're starting with the idea of reparation before they get to the idea of what the highway should look like or what the streets should look like. Ironically, the highway they're talking about there in Minnesota is a highway we have here in the city of Detroit as well, I-94, which goes west from here to Minneapolis. But it was just a reminder for me of how troubling and how frustrating the process here has been the whole time. These are not things that anybody has really suggested who's part of the process or the decision-making process here. And yet in Minneapolis, they're much further ahead than we are. It seems often in Detroit, if you look to other communities, they're doing it in a way that that makes us envious and somewhat sorrowful, I think. Malachi, when you talk to city and state officials, do they ever even reference this kind of idea or program?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of this is it kind of started, the concept of a boulevard, from my understanding, started with a planning grant that Kresge had gave to DGC to study the boulevard idea. And so there were kind of talks around 2014 about how removing the freeway and turning into a boulevard could kind of reconnect parts of downtown to those Lower East Side neighborhoods. And, you know, the federal government came in, I guess it would have been like 2 years ago now, with some grant money that is part of a national effort to reconnect communities that have been divided by highways. And so that piece of it has really kind of emerged throughout the process. But I don't know. I mean, the federal kind of Thriving Communities grant was an opportunity to add that element, I think, to this design that maybe initially, I don't know. I think that's a complicated, I mean, we're seeing it in motion still, right?
Yeah, we are. I'm not sure where we end up, and I'm not sure at what point the thing turns toward this kind of reparative discussion.
I don't think I've heard as part of any of these conversations what you had mentioned about the access to financing and land that has been going on in other parts of the country with these federally backed projects. Mm-hmm. I think if that was brought into the conversation, it might provide more of a, you know, concrete example for things that people are looking for when it comes to the land use.
Yeah.
But from my understanding, I don't really think that's been a part of the conversation so far.
And I've looked at the environmental assessment closely, the one that was conducted and approved in 2021 by the Federal Highway Administration. And all of the restorative justice, anything that relates to Black Bottom, anything that relates to community enhancements, all of the kind of community benefits that are supposed to come out of this to mitigate the potential impacts are all supposed to be funded by the sale of the land. Mm. yet that we don't know how the land is supposed to be sold. MDOT is still trying to figure that out. And when will this land be sold?
Yeah.
I think we all are conversant in Detroit development. There is a lot of vacant land near downtown that has not yet been developed. Mm-hmm. And I think to say, to ask the residents, the small business owners, and anyone who is impacted by the highway removal, you know, when it happened, to wait till the land for the land to be sold and then for that to fund community benefits, and that is just completely unrealistic.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's, and you know, I think for, you know, Carl and I are not experts in restorative justice.
We're not
traffic engineers. No. We're, you know, we have been talking with our neighbors and with others who are concerned, and what we are asking for is for MDOT, for the, you know, for our elected leaders to take a moment, really think about the impact of this project, and to reform this process that they're using.
Yeah.
Because we're not pretending like we know exactly how to fix, you know, this freeway design. That is beyond the capacity of any individual resident or business owner.
Yeah, go ahead, Carl.
And you know, I just think that they're looking at this from repairing a wrongdoing of, you know, how they built the road to begin with, all right? So they're overlooking the fact that when they did that, they ripped up families, okay, and, you know, took away, you know, a thriving area, and we get a, you know, a freeway out of it, which I think they need to go back, and that's why we say rethink, okay? It's not a road project. This is a neighborhood transformational project. So let's look at it from that perspective, all right? And then the road becomes a byproduct of it, as opposed to, you know, the what we keep hearing, it's a road project. No, this is a transformative neighborhood project, okay, that we really need to step back and take a look at it from that lens and not look at it from the road project perspective.
Yeah. I want to read a social media comment from James, who says, a cement monument can't replace reparations now owed. He says, solicit residents who were uprooted. My first house was on Maple and Shane, 1951. We're still around. As I said, you can't be in Detroit very long without running into people who lived in this area and were affected by all the things that happened at the town halls that were held, which they were. I mean, MDOT has held meetings for people to talk. What has been the tenor of what people have said?
So I think it's important to for everyone to understand exactly what kinds of public engagement have taken place. There were town halls in 2017. I honestly don't remember those town halls. Those were about the boulevard.
Mm-hmm.
So the project at that time was from Gratiot to the river, and it was just the boulevard. The interchange was not affected. In 2018 and 2019, MDOT held meetings with its local advisory council at that time. Carl and I were not members of that local advisory council. Nope. We were not involved. There may have been, we've heard that there were other community meetings, neighborhood meetings. There's nothing in the public record about public town halls, those kinds of meetings. If people in our community were invited, you know, that's great, but that kind of engagement in small groups does not replace widespread engagement.
Yeah.
In 2019, they added in the interchange project sometime in 2018, 2019. Those were shared with the local advisory council at that time. The first time that was shared publicly in a widespread way was when they were coming for public comment in 2021. In January of 21, during the pandemic, in a city where we were teaching our children from home and people were struggling for their lives.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's hard, you know, I'm sure some people were engaged, but when we talk to our neighbors, when we show up to the public engagement that's happening now, people are either shocked and confused that the project is taking place or have serious concerns. And the kinds of concerns that we're hearing from our neighbors and small businesses are about pedestrian safety, about public safety, access to the Detroit Medical Center, which will be severely impacted by the design of this project. What's going to happen to this land? tell us more about what this reconnecting communities project means. You know, those are the, you know, how will my small business be affected? Those are the concerns that we continue to hear. So it very well may be that this engagement took place,
right,
but the concerns were not addressed.
Right. Yeah. And that's one of the things that, you know, I've pointed out several times, I think, to the officials, is that you collect this data, you hear these comments, you hear these questions, and you get no answers. I mean, there's nothing that's been distilled to say that, you know, public safety will be addressed this way, mm-hmm. right? We were on a call a couple weeks ago, and one of the officials said that, well, you know, no one walks from this area to Easton Market. And that was, I was floored by that comment. That just tells me this person's never even been in the area to understand that, you know, the majority of the people will take that walk, you know.
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
it's just things like that, that the information is certainly, those forums probably occurred. Information was taken, and then it was put on a shelf somewhere.
Yeah, yeah. Again, Jacqueline, really appreciate your call and that important info about your history here in the city. Let's go next to Peter in Detroit. Peter, what's on your mind?
Good morning. Hey, love the new show, and especially that new Sam Bobian theme song. Love
you it. Like the music?
oh, yeah. Steven, here's what my concern is number one, I think they're rushing it. And the other thing is that they're being so uncreative. And, you know, if you're going to do a big project, look to where things like this have been done other places and learn from other people's mistakes and learn from successes. In Washington, D.C., and in a lot of other cities, there is a highway that runs right underneath the mall because they weren't going to plow through the mall. They let the mall up there. They tunneled under. Well, 375 is already in a big ditch. Why not build over the top of that and put a community and stores and everything else over the top of that? You still keep 375. The concerns for how are people going to get downtown, that's gone, and you can build a community up there that is what people want.
Yeah.
That is what, you know, engage them and find out what is it that we want to do. But you can have both things if you're creative enough.
Yeah, Peter, I love that you called and suggested that, because I, you know, one of my questions from the beginning is, why would you want to get rid of the freeway and replace it with a road that acts like a freeway?
Right.
What's the difference? You know, and also, if you put 6 or 9 lanes at grade instead of sunken, now you're asking people to cross that if they want to get from the neighborhoods on the east side into downtown. I don't walk across Woodward in
That's
most
right.
places because it's too wide. I don't walk across Gratiot, even at a light, because it's too wide and it seems dangerous. You would create that same phenomenon there. And so why not think about getting rid of the freeway and creating a community with, I don't know, 1 or 2 lane streets and housing and shopping and all those things. And that was never seemed to be on the boards here. It never seemed to be part of what they were considering. And I love the idea of tunneling as well, right? The Big Dig in Boston is an example of that, although that was a kind of fraught project. Maybe we don't want to idolize that one too much, but the idea is what's important. And I wonder, Malachi, if it is too late to think of it in those terms.
I think the MDOT has said they're pretty committed to the boulevard design. You know, the details of it could be tweaked, but the concept of raising it and turning into a boulevard is pretty set in stone. I think largely because they've talked about safety issues with the curve that comes into downtown, and also the expense and the difficulty of maintaining those bridges that cross over. I think they would like to not have to worry about that asset anymore, even though it does provide some separation. It's a little bit easier to cross that because, you know, while you are kind of elevated and it feels maybe less safe, you're not actually crossing the traffic in the same way that you would if you're at the ground level.
Right.
It's interesting to talk about the capping idea because DDOT actually was or the U.S. Department of Transportation has a grant that was provided the Downtown Detroit Partnership for capping I-75 a little bit north there. And the idea was
near Woodward, right?
Yeah, you create kind of a tunnel that makes a better connection to downtown and like Brush Park in the Midtown area. And maybe you turn that into a park, or you allow housing or businesses there. So that's something that is kind of in early conversations in, a couple miles away from this project. But it doesn't seem like there's the same kind of potential for a kind of covering of I-375.
Yeah. That was my conversation with Bridge Detroit reporter Malachi Barrett and Olga Stella and Carl Bentley, two members of the Rethink I-375 Coalition, about the state's plans to eliminate this little spur highway on the east side of Detroit and hopefully try to make up for the damage that it created to the communities, the black communities that were there. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll have more Created Equal. We'll hear from Princeton historian Eddie Glau. Welcome back to Created Equal on Juneteenth, 2024. We're spending our time today listening back to conversations we've had on Created Equal that, like Juneteenth, are kind of representative of inflection points in our long journey toward equality in America. I'm Stephen Henderson. I'm here with Carrie Jr. II, the show's producer. Mm-hmm. In this next segment, we're going to listen back to a conversation with Eddie Glau, who's a Princeton historian, somebody who thinks a lot about not just the history of inequality, but present day inequality and how we work together, really, to make sure that more equality gets fulfilled in America.
His approach was a lot more idealistic than I had assumed it would be.
Yeah. I mean, I think he's hopeful, right? I mean, mm-hmm. I think he's not naive, but he's hopeful. He believes in the American promise, and he believes in the American people and our ability to work together to deliver on that promise. I mean, I think he knows we're not there, but he can kind of see a day mm-hmm. when maybe we get there. One of my favorite things about you is how prolific you are on Twitter. I can always kind of follow what you're thinking about. But you asked on February 8th of this year, why do Democrats continue to engage Republicans as good faith actors? Which I think is a really provocative question. And I kind of want to broaden that a bit and talk about the idea of good faith and the role that you think it plays, not just in racial reckoning and has to play in racial reckoning, but the role that it plays in the systemic change overall that you see us in need of in this country. It seems to me that so much of the American compact rests on the idea of that good faith. And I get the sense that for you, you're not seeing it. You don't see it as intact.
Right. It's one thing for us to disagree about what freedom entails. It's one thing for us to disagree about what flourishing in the U.S. mm-hmm. consists in, right? And what's the responsibility of government in helping us in our individual lives. We can have a disagreement on the role of government, but we could hold a joint commitment that every human being should, in the United States in particular, should not only be able to dream dreams, but to make their dreams a reality. How we go about arguing or thinking about how that happens, mm-hmm. we could disagree, right? But there's some background conditions that allow us to have that disagreement, right? But I think that there are those who hold views who are engaging in public deliberation or public argument who aren't being honest about what motivates their positions. Right? They believe, many of these people, that America belongs mm-hmm. to white people. and more importantly, belongs to rich white people, right? And they're willing to exploit grievance and fear, right, in the name of a certain set, in the name of that vision. And then they present that, that's what's motivating their claims, but then they present it in a way that has us arguing about, right, the role of government, is overreach, right, you know, healthcare, you know, all this stuff. And it seems to me, if people aren't honest about what motivates their positions, it becomes very difficult to engage them, right? So, you know, if I hear states' rights, Steve, if I hear that argument, I'm going to immediately move to there. That's just a code for racism. But somebody might actually believe in it. But it's we got to be able to engage in the back and forth in order to see. But in this current moment, man, it's so much bad faith that that trust, which is at the heart of any deliberative democracy, can't be presumed.
And so where does that leave us, I think, is the question that always jumps into my mind. You know, I mean, there are a lot of people who say, this is broken. This is fundamentally broken and probably can't put it back together because of the things that you're pointing out, that that this this idea of acting in good faith is so broken. But that doesn't seem to me a very practical way to think about it. I mean, what does that mean? We're going to divide everything up and go our separate ways, or, you know, something worse than that. So in your mind, where does that, what does that ask us to do? What does the moment, I guess, call for if that's where we are?
You know, I think it calls for almost a kind of a moment where we give voice to a new social compact.
Huh.
Right? What are our obligations to each other? And what does it, what are some baseline things that we could all agree on that if you're American, that this is where we all start? You know, everyone should have a decent roof over their heads. Everyone should be able to, you know, to put food on the table. Everyone shouldn't go broke because they're sick. Every child should have a decent education. What's our social compact? What are our social obligations to each other? And what's the role of government in ensuring that baseline, you know, level of existence? We have to have that argument, because what I think, where we are now is that some people believe that they, that certain things belong to them, that a certain social contract is only relevant to them and to theirs. And the other, all of us of us should just simply shut up and be grateful that we're here. So I think part of the way in which we rebuild trust is we have to state clearly, not in the name of some, you know, myth, some ideology of American innocence or you know, perfection, right? But rather, this is who we are. And then to build a way of life, a set of policies that actually make it a reality.
Yeah. It does.
Does that make sense?
It does. And just sitting and listening to you articulate that reminds me of, you know, the power that gave birth, and the thinking that gave birth to the civil rights movement, right? And its sort of apex in the late 50s and 1960s. But that was a pretty difficult time in our history. I mean, not the most difficult, but there was a lot of tragedy that unfolded as a result of African Americans taking that very position that you're talking about. There was a lot of struggle, and yes, we got an enormous amount of change, of structural change. But then here we are, almost, you know, 50 some years later, and we're still talking about the same stuff. And we're talking about it in an environment where it's very difficult to imagine that you could muster the same will and organization and sacrifice that people did back then.
Well, look, the last piece of what was the last major piece of legislation of the goods of the Great Society was
Fair Housing Act
of 1968. Yeah. 12 years later, Reagan is elected to undo it. Just 12 years. So you think 15 years from the Voting Rights Act. So the social revolution of the mid-20th century, right, was immediately under assault as it was happening. And then Reaganism, right, was emerged as an ideological counter to that. And right now we're relitigating everything. The Black Freedom Movement, the women's movement, the gay liberation movement, we're right squarely there. And so I think it's important for us to understand that Reaganism or neoliberalism or however we want to describe it is collapsing right in front of us. Trumpism is a caricatured version of it. But all of the contradictions of that economic philosophy, of that political philosophy, all of those contradictions are in full view. And the challenge for us is not to kind of long for the stability of early forms of Reaganism. Our task in this moment, it seems to me, Brother Stephen, is as this is collapsing, to imagine something different, to step into this critical juncture, and to do the political work of imagining a different relationship to each other. And the challenge we face, I think, is that you have people who want a sense of normalcy by, you know, longing for the very thing that sought to undo what the mid-20th century revolution was all about.
The undoing of it is the thing that I think we've lived with for 50 years, right? Up to the current moment where you have a presidential candidate, back to the beginning of our conversation, who says, even our history is not what we say it is.
You know, Baldwin said, you know, the price of the ticket is that these folk have to become white. And Ralph Ellison talked about this tricky magic in Shadow and Act. You know, he has this wonderful formulation where he says, when, you know, the country has yet to discover itself.
Yes.
And when the contradictions of its identity come into full view, right, it engages in the scapegoat. It engages in these horrific rituals in order to consolidate a notion of whiteness. And it's, he says, that's that tricky magic. And so we find ourselves in this moment where the alchemist are doing their thing. And we need to understand it for what it is and not concede, you know, not concede the ground. Yeah.
That was my conversation a few months ago with Princeton professor of African American Studies, Eddie Gloud, about how we move forward with the equality agenda in America, how we move forward together, not one race or another or one demographic or another, but how we as Americans figure out how to restore a sense of justice and make things more equal for people who have experienced inequality for such a long time. A great way to end our celebration of Juneteenth, Carrie Jr. This is a nice bow to wrap on all of this.
It was. I mean, he definitely has some ambitious dreams. The social contract, this kind of restructuring how we view and trust one another. But I think it's also enough and a good place, a good amount of information for folks to think about when we think about Juneteenth. And through this episode, I think, especially with what Glaude had to say about really being ambitious about how we understand each other's intentions around addressing this, at least helped me, I think about a more optimistic way to communicate about what's going on as it regards to our racial history in this country. And trust that folks are willing to listen, and hopefully we can make the incremental change necessary to realize what the freedoms and equality really are.
And one of the key tenets of what Glaude believes and talks about is that you can't get any of this done without an attention to justice itself, right? Mm-hmm. To making sure that just outcomes are the foundation for the idea of equality. That's so important. And mm-hmm. it ends up being the kind of sticking point or the difficulty in a lot of these conversations right. and a lot of the things that we try to do. But you can't give up on that. You have to insist, I think, that justice, doing the right thing, correcting wrongs, is the first step toward making sure that everyone truly is equal. That's it for Created Equal. You can listen to recent episodes at WDET.org and make sure to subscribe to our podcast, where you can leave us a rating or a review. Created Equal is produced by Carrie Jr. II and David Lines. The audio editing is by Connor Anderson, and the music is by Sam Bobian. Created Equal is a production of WDET, a listener-supported service of Wayne State University.